Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And I miss Paul. We'll have Paul back tomorrow. at least for a couple of days, and we'll find out what he's got on his plate, because I know he's pretty busy. Anyway, we're going through Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, and one of the two things that really are critical, you hear me talk about these, one of the things that was really critical, because there was a minority of states that held to the premise that they had to have slavery. Those three states were the Carolinas and Georgia. Virginia and the rest of the states were, as a matter of fact, the farther you move north, the more adamant they were against slavery. And so Virginia was actually on the side of ending slavery. And so we will get to the point when George Mason, Colonel Mason, makes this, I'll just say, pontificates the Civil War because of the political compromise that occurred. What's really amazing is how these men worked in sitting down and creating the Constitution through, you know, initial resolutions, subcommittees, and so forth. And the way they discussed and got into each of the issues, and how the end product came to be, and the way I look at this process, I'm just amazed that, one, they were able to come together so quickly. I can't see that happening today. And that's really because reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree. Those men were reasonable and they were equally informed. And so they did disagree. There were certain things that they held, you know, standards on because of, you know, their paradigms or the uniquenesses of their situations. And when I say they disagreed, it was really because of their world. I mean, when you look at labor, when you look at religion, they were different. So, I mean, if you go into a meeting with a bunch of people that, you know, are just random people off the street, and you end up bringing up religion, and you'll find that everybody has actually their own religion, you will not find much agreement between those people. And so you can see the subdivisions and so forth between how they were kind of brought up. So that's why I'm saying it, to me, is just, I'm absolutely amazed with the amount of time and the way they just worked and worked and worked and worked, and the way they discussed it and argued it, that they were able to come to these agreements. This, to me, is more of a, I'll just say, a testament to the divine hand of providence and the inspiration that these men were filled with, especially after they began having prayer on a daily basis. Now, what we're going through right now, what I'm deciphering or pulling out of these debates, because I'm just doing these word searches, and I mean, who would be calling me at this point in time? And so we're just doing these word searches on very specific topics. One of those topics would be property. And when we talk about property, I was thinking, and I was going down this path of really looking at land and the admission and the enumeration of property. And that's because, you know, there's on the western side of this continent, or I should say on the Mississippi west side of this continent, there is a really onerous burden that the federal government is placing upon the states, not so much on the eastern side. And I will tell you that if those same burdens were placed upon the eastern side of the Mississippi, there, the people would not be happy. They would not like their whole entire life change. I mean, with people coming in and buying up, not people, the BLM and so forth, buying up your property and making that property unusable and basically just trying to restore it back to they would be forcing everybody into concrete buildings, into cities and mass control. And that is the agenda. Now, I don't believe in the 1800s when they founded the Home Department, which is now the Department of Interior. I don't believe it was their intent to have that level of control. But one side of control, you know, one little wall out in the forest where you put your feed, you know, that becomes, you know, just a wall. But when you put a second wall abutting to it at a 90-degree angle, and you start putting some, you know, bait or food for the pigs or the wild animals, well, okay, and the animals come on a regular basis. So as you keep on putting food there, they come and eat. And eventually they get trapped, if you understand the process of trapping. And so that's kind of how this really slowly fell together. But I believe that those people in the 1800s that were initially establishing this, maybe that wasn't their real design. I think that there were a few people that may have had a better understanding of how this was all going to work down the way or as time moved on. But the way the federal government has assumed the ownership of property. Now, we've gone through the ratification base, and we're going to go through them again. And in the ratification base, they talk about the enumeration of powers, what the federal government is authorized to possess. And they basically lay it all out that is found in Article 1, Section 8. Those are the enumerations to the federal government from the states. That's where you'll find in the Constitution, you'll find the enumeration for property as well. And so when you look at Article 1, Section 8, and actually it is subsection 16, and this is where it basically allows them to exercise, so they have this exclusive authority over their own land. And then they also have that same like authority, when I say their own land, the District of Columbia. The first part of this is all about the District of Columbia. And to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. So in other words, the only type of land that the federal government can possess in a state is land that, one, they actually have to purchase, and two, it has to be for these specific reasons. Did you hear me say forests? No. Did you hear me say parks, recreation, monuments, national monuments? No. For the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings, not big masses of land, a needful building. So what would a needful building be? Well, let's just say you happen to have a border state. When I say a border state, let's look at Montana. Montana has a very long border. And so roads going in and out of the United States would require a needful building for basically for checking the importation of goods and the travel of people and so forth to ensure we have good measures in controlling what is coming in and, you know, who's coming in and so forth. We also have that same requirement to have a needful building at the airport if the aircraft that is landing in that state's airport is coming from a foreign land. They don't need to have a needful building with every terminal to check and everything else. So when you look at how they redefined this, now remember, Article 1, Section 8 is where all things that are granted to the federal government are listed. Now there are roles and responsibilities that are granted, but not powers or property. In other words, you can possess these properties for national security purposes. That's why they've listed those things. The United States was not to be rich in resources where it could buy and corrupt the states. This is why when you look at how they were framing this government, nobody ever thought, and because it was never the design, to allow it to be able to lure the states to come along. And the anticipation was that, oh, well, the federal government would never spend money on something that didn't have the authority to. But as soon as the collusion started between the states and the Treasury and the federal government, using the Treasury to hand them money, oh, this is how states started just letting them do things outside those defined parameters. It took a little while to get there, but after they started doing it, it just got easier and easier, and they started really running away with it. So as we look at this, now I've got a document. Because I think it stands as a great testament of how the federal government has deemed their control over state property. And it is basically like this. And this is the constitutional basis for federal land ownership, the property clause. Now, I just read you the property clause. I want you to be clear. That right there is the property. This is what the federal government can possess in addition to the District of Columbia. Now, what they're going to read to you is actually out of Article 4, Section 3. That is not the property clause. That is the responsibility for the federal government in admitting new states into the Union. And so this is what they say, because they basically break this down as if it's a standalone clause, that this clause stands on its own. If that was the case, it would be Article 4, Section 4, and then Section 4 would be Section 3. But no, this is the second paragraph, the second part, the ancillary part of Section 3, admitting new states into the Union. So this is what this document says. The U.S. Constitution addresses the relationship of the federal government to lands. The property clause, Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2, actually, it's really not Clause 2. I mean, if I look at this, there are actually several clauses in the paragraph above this. The first clause would be, new states may be admitted into this union. That's one clause. But no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of another state. Second clause. The third clause, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as of the Congress. That's the third clause. The fourth clause is what they're actually calling the second clause, and they're also calling this, you know, the property clause, when actually it's the ancillary granting of the responsibility in the federal government in admitting new states. So they're the ones that need to admit the new states. States should not have had, nor do they need to worry about bringing new states into the Union. And so, again, this is what it says here. Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2 gives Congress authority over the lands, territory, or other property of the United States. It reads, and I'm just going to take a quick aside here. I actually read this idiot lawyer, and I believe he was in Massachusetts, that actually said that all land within the United States is under the jurisdiction and control of the United States government. That flies. That little comment, that paradigm, flies in complete contrast to the way the Constitution and the way this republic was formed with independent and sovereign states. How did we get to such oblivion, where people are so obviously ignorant of, you know, the sources and the origins of this nation? How do we get this far? How is somebody actually in the bar practicing? This guy is, you know, like an influencer in law. I'm going, how is this happening? I guess if you lie and you can do it with a straight face and you can use as much vinegar as you possibly can, then you get promoted and elevated as long as you're deceiving the people from the truth. Let me read on. So this is what it says. The Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. So when the territory of Indiana was in the functioning of itself. Now, let's just look at the founding document of this republic being the Declaration of Independence, which kind of set the tone that all governments are instituted by we the people. So when the federal government had these territories, they had a huge incentive in getting states into the union. Well, why? Why weren't they in a hurry of creating and organizing territories to make them states? Well, in the very beginning, the more states they could add, the more they could lay tax upon them. States, based on the Constitution, can be taxed. And all states are taxed based on apportionment. So the more states and the more the states were growing, then, you know, we actually had a thing going on where the federal government was going to make more money. So they were incentivized to help speed the process along. So getting back to all governments being instituted by we the people, when the federal government started organizing your state and creating county governments, they bypassed you, the people. This is why there's no county in all of the new states that were formed. That's not one county that I know of. And if you know of a county that's got a constitution, please let me know. But the bottom line is that we, the people, did not institute those county governments. The federal government appointed a judge, and the judge probably found a sheriff, because the governing really came from the lawyers who were out there trying to prepare everything. And, you know, in those days, they weren't really that subversive regarding the Constitution. They were just, you know, they had quotas to meet. They needed to make more money. But bottom line, when you read what I just read, the Congress shall have the power to dispose of lands and make needful rules and regulations respecting the territory. Well, is a territory the state? Let me ask you this. Can you have a territory within a sovereign state? Can a foreign nation, can some other governing entity exist within a sovereign state? If there is, it's not a sovereign state. In other words, it's sharing sovereignty. And the design of this republic was not a design where the sovereignty could be shared. Each state must be independent and sovereign states, and they were parties to the compact. Every time a state joined the union, it became a party to it. And so when we kind of finish this up, and other property belonging to the United States, okay, so that means that if there's other property, like a military installation, then they can make needful rules and regulations for that institution within that state. Now, is a fort, magazine, are those authorized? Yes, absolutely. Is a park authorized? No, it's not. The only way the federal government, that's why I read you the property clause. The only way they can own any land within a state is they have to first buy it. So what ended up happening? In 1860, they started putting reservations on land. Well, you know, we don't want you to do things with this land. We want to make sure that it is always a state resource. And then they actually started holding back and saying, this is going to be federal land. They never had the authority to do that. It was a slow, gradual creeping of power and, I'll just say, nefarious possessions. So as they kind of go through this, I could read the rest of this congressional report, but I can tell you that their foundation, as they just started off their foundation, it has no base. It is not connected at all to the Constitution, nor the ratification debates, nor what we're going through now in Madison's notes on the Constitution, because we're going to get into this. We're going to get into the fact that when states join the Union, they have the right of self-determination. They have the right of being able to do everything they need to. The only reason why we had forts and national reserves and so forth in the middle of the nation was because we had hostile, or we actually started creating, because they changed their foreign affairs, or I should say they changed their relationship with Indians after the first couple of presidents. As a matter of fact, as things started moving more towards the Democrat run with Jackson and so forth, things just went sideways. When you look basically from Washington to Monroe, there was pretty much a consistent policy regarding the Indians. The Indians were being assimilated and they were kicking butt. They were doing great. They were beating white men, if you want to call it that, or they were beating the others in the same area, the same states. They were beating them at their own game. The first paper, I think this was either Kevin Gutzman or Tom Woods, probably Gutzman, that in his book he basically talked about how the Cherokees were actually running a newspaper in the southern states. And it was one of the first printed papers in the area. And they were being so successful that the people of the southern states pleaded and demanded that Jackson get rid of them and march them west. And like a fool, like a tyrant, Jackson did. I mean, Jackson did a couple things right, but he did a lot of things really, really wrong. He had no authority to do that. So here's the problem, and I've had this conversation with a lot of people. When the federal government, does it wrong, gets it wrong, or what have you, what kind of restoration can they give? Can they actually pay? Technically, no. They can give you your land back. If they took your land, if there was actual land from these people, the Cherokees or what have you, that were driven out, if they actually acquired or established, because in those days, you had either bought the land, because there were plenty of people doing land speculation in all of the original 13 states. Jefferson was one of them. Washington was another. They were buying land and creating deeds because land was cheap. And so if the Cherokees did a homestead where they, just kind of create, because the land was available, they just homestead, and they basically acquired that land through a homestead, then that was their land. And so whoever owns and possesses that land today, woe be unto them, because if we ever fix the problem, that land is going to go back to the rightful owners. Because it's like if somebody takes the Mona Lisa out of the Louvre, I believe that's where it's at in France. If somebody takes that and for hundreds of years it, is in obscurity or what have you, and just because it's a famous painting, let's just say, all the history books get destroyed and everything else. And, as far as common knowledge, nobody knows that is, actually property of the Louvre. However, when somebody actually comes along and they say, hey, that painting there, that belongs to these people over here. Even hundreds of years later, as it is transcended from one generation to the next within a family and sold off to another family and sold off to another family for millions of dollars and so forth and so on, nobody has a right to obtain any form of what I call restitution for what they just lost in paying for that, because that person had no legal right to selling it, just like the other people down that chain. But the point of our government, the point of common law, is to restore that original property back, not to restore the finances, harm and the owies or hurt feelings. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so what I was trying to get to is pain and suffering. There's no reparations for pain and suffering. There's no reparations for opportunities lost. We are to get things right, and we do everything we possibly can to get things right. Now, when it comes to somebody stripping you, now when it comes down to legitimate stripping, because can the federal government take your property for eminent domain? Absolutely they can. They put it in the law, and they actually put in with the law just compensation. That doesn't mean that down the road, now was there any just compensation from those people? No, not at all. And there may have been just compensation for, you know, what it may have been at the time. I guess you might be able to argue that. But it wasn't an eminent domain thing, because actually it was a strict violation of the Constitution. There is no allowance in the Constitution for the government at all to take land from a private party and give it to another private party. They can't do it. It was an absolute violation. And this is why, you know, I look at Andrew Jackson, the fact that, you know, first off, the framers didn't even like, and they articulated, they clamored about not wanting their faces on the money. They did not want to become demigods. They did not want to be, you know, a part of any idol worshiping. Because that's how they saw it. They didn't even want memorials. The fact that Washington, D.C. is filled with all these memorials, especially for all of these different people, you know, speaks to the problem of what's happened to us as a people. You know, we have to idolize. I mean, it's almost like I kind of made a reference to this last week, that how fast do people regress to, you know, their base instincts or how life was before? I mean, look at the Egyptians, or I should say the Israelites that left Egypt, right? I mean, how long was Moses up on the mount before they started, you know, gathering gold to build a golden calf? And I kind of laugh and say, you know, if somebody came to me and asked me for my gold to, you know, to be put into this community calf, I'm sorry. You ain't getting it. And I would never have allowed that. I wouldn't have done it, nor, you know, I can't say that I wouldn't have succumbed, because, you know, I didn't live at that point in time. I didn't have those. I would have been a completely different person, right? Fact of the matter is that the government is constrained. The United States government cannot create bills of attainder and punishment, nor can they create ex post facto laws, something that was legitimate or legal at the time. Now, clearly, it was a violation, and the one thing that has to happen is that land has to be restored. But the other thing is the fact that the federal government, based on the 14th Amendment, all Indians under the jurisdiction of the United States, in other words, if they're living on a territory or they've already become and assimilated as citizens, they're already citizens. Do they have an opportunity to be dual citizens? I don't think that there's such a thing with the Indians. I think it's more of a cultural than it is a citizenship. I mean, it's just like a person that has the affinity or an affiliation, whether that be by bloodline to a family tradition, to a cultural tradition, or what have you. And I know that there's probably a lot of people that are being offended. I'm not sitting down here thinking of what to, you know, how to articulate this to be very clear, but I hope I am making my point, is that this Constitution and this land was actually a land for all people to have to enjoy the full breadth of liberty. Liberty is not just freedom. Liberty is you have to be responsible and accountable for those harms that you've created. And it's a place where government cannot control you. Bottom line, the federal government has been mucking around for a long time with blacks up until the 60s, even though the 14th Amendment got it right. And they've been mucking still to this day with Indians. If Indians in America who are American citizens do not want to be American citizens anymore, then they can go through the process of being inhabitants. But any land that they own within a state, it's going to be taxable. You're going to have to pay taxes. You may not have to pay income tax, federal income tax, but you're still, if you're going to be within that state, you're going to be at least a citizen of that state. And I don't know how people can remove themselves from being like the sovereign citizen movement. It just makes no sense. Are you telling me that the state doesn't have the authority to build its own roads and highways? Absolutely it does. Now, whether it's in their constitution or not is another problem. But if they do have the authority, and they should have that authority, because what are we going to do? Are we really going to be building our own roads to where, you know, I got to build my own road to get me to work and then to the store and to my church? I mean, in the old days, you know, there were these community trails. You know, I'd have my own trail out to the main, the first community trail that would take me to another community trail that would take me to another main community trail that a lot of people used. But are we really going to go back to that? And so if the states build the roads, do they have the ability to actually make, you know, rules and regulations? You know, you got to understand because we want you to drive on this side of the road. We want you to understand. So for safety purposes, I mean, the anarchists say, no, we don't want the government's intrusion in our lives. We have the right to do what I'm sorry, that doesn't fly. We the people institute our governments, and we actually did institute these state governments, even though we didn't really institute those county governments. There's some things we need to fix. There's a lot of things. Absolutely, folks, we've got a lot of things to fix, and it has to start with the county. And I will say this, and I've been in a monologue all the first half of the show and going into this far into the show. I will say this, that why counties matter most really helps people start to understand the paradigm. Whether if you're a sovereign citizen and you want to have a democracy, sorry, you have to go somewhere else and live in another nation that'll give you your democracy or allow you to be the anarchist you want to be. We are a nation of laws, and we are a Republican form of government. We're not a party form of government. We're not a socialist form of government. We're not a democratic form of government. And so I believe most of those who have been duped into becoming sovereign citizens, the real attraction for them was really about money. And it's very unfortunate. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, when a person gives up their citizenship, then they're no longer entitled. And I'd like to see law enforcement actually educated on this stuff so that when they pull somebody over and somebody actually says, hey, you know, I'm a sovereign citizen. You don't have any jurisdiction over me. Well, near as I can tell, I do. You happen to be here, and if we don't know who you are, we're just going to arrest you and deport you. Because the state can actually, if you're not a U.S. citizen, then a state can actually deport you. If you have no citizenship, then where are they going to deport you to? I guess to a land of your choice, I say we start deporting these guys. Let people understand what the consequences of what you're doing. You can't vote. You have no say here. You've given up, and you deserve to go. It's the same thing with those who actually are working the insurrection against the Constitution. They've not given up. They are actually attacking. They are the insurgents. And there are many of them that are in government. And they definitely don't belong here. And this is where the Tory acts come along. Because anybody that's loyal to another governing system does not belong here and needs to be deported. Go read the Tory Acts, my friends. The Tory Acts was the basis of removing the British loyalists after the Revolution. There was like 100,000 people that they rounded up, and many of them went to Canada. Lots of them, like the Belvoirs, I know the Belvoirs, they went back to England and, you know, reassimilated back under the crown. Interesting, right? When people look at property, this is one of the reasons why, you know, we have this, I'll just say this affinity with property. And I think it's just the selfishness of man. But when we go through, and that's what we're doing, I'm going to get into Mr. Morris, Governor Morris's statement regarding property. And I believe this has more to do with slavery, if I remember correctly. But let me just dive into this. Because, again, like I said, this is Governor Morris, and he's from Pennsylvania. And, again, I'm going to be focused on property, where we're going to talk a bit about slaves, as well as about land, as well as about states, okay? Mr. Governor Morris thought a committee advisable as the convention had been equally divided. He had a stronger reason also. The mode of appointing the second branch tended, he was sure, to defeat the object of it. What is the object? To check the precipitation, changeableness, and excesses of the first branch. Every man of the observation had seen in the democratic branches of the state legislature precipitation in Congress, changeableness in every department, excesses against personal liberty, private property, and personal safety. So in other words, here's Governor Morris basically saying, hey, you know, the governments we've formed are not very good. We've actually been pretty bad people. What qualities are necessary to constitute a check in this case? Abilities and virtues are equally necessary in both branches. Something more than is now wanted. One, the checking branch must have a personal interest in checking the other branch. One interest must be opposed to the other interest. Vices, as they exist, must be turned against each other. Two, it must have great personal property. It must have the aristocratic spirit. Must love to the Lord it, though pride. Pride is indeed the great principle that actuates both the poor and the rich. It is the principle in the former resist, in the latter abuses authority. Three, it should be independent. In religion, the creature is apt to forget its creator. That it is otherwise in political affairs, the late debates. Here are an unhappy proof. The aristocratic body should be as independent and as firm as the democratic. So now when he's talking about the aristocratic body, if you're looking at the Senate was in England, in Parliament, the House of Lords was the aristocratic body. Here's the interesting thing. When we looked at the senators, or I should say actually the House of Lords had double representation. And what I mean by that is the people that appointed those who were occupants had seats in the House of Lords. They were appointed by the aristocratic body. But guess what? The aristocratic body also had and went in and elected people that they wanted in their house. So in other words, they actually had personal representation in two houses. and it had no affiliation towards, you know, this constituency. Or when we look at the American model, when you look at the state legislature is not a body of just rich people. The state legislature is a body of representatives, and the way it was done then was representatives of the people of the county and representatives of the government of the county and the Senate. So when we looked at how the state legislature would function, the state legislature would function based on the vicinage and those who they were giving suffrage to. They were not, and by design, they were not going to be an aristocracy. At this point in time, Wilson is injecting this paradigm of an aristocracy. That's why I wanted to break this aside and say, hey, he's talking and looking at as if the model that they were creating was like Parliament, and it did not end up even remotely looking like Parliament. Back to Governor Morris. If the members of it are to revert to a dependence on the Democratic choice, the Democratic scale will preponderate. All the guards contrived by America have not restrained the senatorial branches of the legislatures from a servile compliance to the Democratic. If the second branch is to be dependent, we are better without it. To make it independent, it should be for life. You see? Now he's actually talking about a lifetime term, almost like a monarchy, almost like England. But in England, and I think that in England, it is common that they are appointed and they just stay in for life. That they don't go up for re-election. I believe it's just the appointment of the aristocracy. It will then do wrong, because I really don't know. I've never studied England that much, but I do know a little bit, and I do know that the people who appoint also have the opportunity to elect in the House of Commons. It will then do wrong, it will be said. He believes so. He hopes so. The rich will strive to establish their dominion and enslave the rest. They always did, they always will, and they are today. This is why when we really look at who are the enemies of the republic, who are the enemies of the governing system of the people, are those who absolutely obtain power on their own, those who corrupt people on their own, Bill Gates, Soros, Buffett, all of these people that have this affluence and the ability to actually corrupt people. As a matter of fact, you hear people all the time go, how much would, you know, what would it take for you to allow that to happen? For your, you know, for some, you know, like somebody to sleep with your partner, your spouse, or to do some evil thing. You know, hey, what is your cost? And unfortunately, there's way too many people that actually have a price. It should always be your life. Anyway, Governor Morris goes on and says, the proper security against them is to form them into a separate interest. The two forces will then control each other. Let the rich mix the poor and the commercial country. They will establish an oligarchy. Take away commerce and democracy will triumph. Thus, it has been all over the world. So it will be among us. Reason tells us we are but men, and we are not to expect any particular inference in heaven in our favor. By thus combining and setting apart the aristocratic interest, the popular interest will be combined against it. Now, it's kind of interesting how he basically kind of talks about how we have these oppositions. And he's really looking towards this democracy, you know, in the first house, and this aristocracy. And actually, he's talking about commerce, those who have the rich and the means. There will be a mutual check and mutual scrutiny. Four, an independent life involves the necessary permanency. If we change our measure, nobody will trust us. And how to avoid a change of measures but by avoiding a change of men. ask any man if he confides in Congress, if he confides in the state of Pennsylvania, if he will then lend his money or enter into contract. He will tell you no. He sees no stability. He can repose no confidence if Great Britain were to explain her refusal to treat with us, the same reasoning would be employed. He disliked the exclusion of the second branch from holding offices. It is dangerous. It is like the imprudent exclusion of the military officers during war from civil appointments. It deprives the executive of the principal source of influence. If danger be apprehended from the executive, what a left-handed way, and that this is something I have not heard, what a left-hand, L-I-F-T-handed, what a left-handed way is this of obviating it? It's got to be jargon of the time. If the son, the brother, or the friend can be appointed, the danger may be increased, as the disqualified father and etc. can then boast of a disinterestedness which he does not possess. Besides, shall all the best, the most able, the most virtuous citizens not be permitted to hold office? Who then are to hold them? He was also against paying the senators. They will pay themselves if they can. If they cannot, they will be rich and they can do without it. Now, see, I'm just here to tell you that, you know, this paradigm of the aristocracy, there's so many problems with it. It does lend to this corruption. But the brilliance, I've got to go back to this. When we look at the Republican form of government and the bicameral legislative bodies in America, the people have their own representation. We elect our representative in all three levels, county, state, and federal. Now, when we don't necessarily have, unless you've got a city, unless you've got that big of a governing body where you have that much money and influence like Los Angeles or a major city, then you do need to actually create districts where you will have a district commissioner, and then you will actually have the people or a committee within that district that would be a sub-district that would actually appoint a senator to oversee, where you would actually have, if you got five districts, you had five senators. And you could have a total of 30, you know, three from each district, 30 representatives. So that actually we would be employing this kind of model where the three representatives in the House at the county level would then select who would be representing in the Senate. Does that make sense? That way they actually have this, I'll just say these aspirations, because at least one of them might be able to become the senator who would run every 4 weeks or every 4 years, or actually I think commissioners, and that's a problem too, having at your county level, having commissioners run 4 year terms. Why do they not have 2 year terms? Well, I guess if it's a small county, but once you go to a big county, once you increase your population, it makes sense to move your lower level, your direct elected commissioners, down to 2 years, and then the appointment of a senator for your district be 4 years, where they would actually have, and this is why when you look at the responsibilities of the House of Representatives to the Senate in the federal constitution, and it should be done the same way in the state constitution, but they didn't do it that way, is to make sure that the Senate is really putting checks on the governance side, and the House is really, you know, not putting checks. Their influence and their responsibility and their powers are on the governance side, you know, like treaties and those types of things, and appointment of executives. When we look at the people, that's where, you know, they have the power, the responsibility over fighting war and the taxation. That's why the Constitution, all bills that require revenue must originate in the House, right? So when we look at these models to where the interest by dividing them, because he's making sense. And apparently this had to have been a common paradigm of having these opposites so that there was a lack of trust that they would have to guard themselves from the encroachments of the other. That absolutely makes sense. But it makes no sense the way our counties are functioning today, especially the fact that you have not instituted them. You have not granted their actual operation. Anyway, of such, the second branch ought to consist, and but none such can oppose it, and are not paid. He contended that the executive should appoint the Senate, fill up vacancies. This gets rid of the difficulty in the present question. You might begin with any ratio you please, if it will come to the same thing. The members being independent and for life may be taken as well from one place to another. It should be considered to how the scheme could be carried through the states. He hoped that there was a strength of mind, Eno, and I have no idea what E-N-O, Eno, in this house to look truth in the face. He did not hesitate, therefore, to say that loaves and fishes must bribe the demagogues. They must be made to expect higher offices under the general than the state governments. A Senate for life will be a notable bait. Without such captivity prospects, the popular leaders will oppose and defeat the plan. He perceived that the first branch was to be chosen by the people of the states. The second, by those chosen by the people. Is there not here a government by the states, a government by compact between Virginia and the first and second branches, Massachusetts and the first and second branch, and etc.? This is going back to mere treaty. It is no government at all. It is altogether dependent on the state and will act over again the part which Congress has acted. A firm government alone can protect our liberties. He fears the influence of the rich. They will have the same effect here as elsewhere if we do not, by such a government, keep them within their proper sphere. So he's already warning about the rich. We should remember that the people never act from reason alone. The rich will take advantage of their passions and make these instruments for oppressing them. The result of the contest will be a violent aristocracy or more violent despotism. The schemes of the rich will be favored by the extent of the country. The people in such distant parts cannot communicate and act in concert. They will be the dupes of those who have more knowledge and intercourse. The only security against encroachments will be a select, sagacious body of men instituted to watch against them on all sides. He meant only to hint these observations without grounding any motion on them. I'm here to tell you, folks, that, you know, when we looked at that at this point in time, the South was really driven by the rich and they were encrusted. Actually, most of the states were that way, but the South even more so, because there was a huge disparity between the big plantations and the smaller farms and so forth, the regular families. I'm hoping this is all starting to really come together. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.